The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
We got a tariff tailspin, a Fed rate hike fiasco, sentiment scoring, and our guest today, Danielle DiMartino Booth from Money Strong. All this and much more on episode number 553 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello there, Andrew Horowitz, and I'm your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Each and every week where we come together and talk about money, finances, markets, what's going on with your thoughts on the general overview of the economy, your comments, your questions, and some great guests. So thanks so much for joining me today. And like I said, each and every Sunday, of course, you get a double dose each and every week when you listen to DH Unplugged on Tuesday night when I join John C. Dvorak at 9 p.m. live. You can hear it live streaming on DH Unplugged. Just come along, join us there for that and some chat. Or you can, of course, download this and the DH Unplugged podcast on wherever fine podcasts are offered, wherever that is. I hope you're having a good weekend. It was a rough week for markets, of course. We saw that, indices across the board here and internationally fell dramatically, 5, 6, 7%, 8% for some. And there's concern. There's definitely concern about some of the things that we talked about last week. And I didn't expect actually to see this degree of just, throwing out the baby with the bathwater when it comes to equities, but there was a lot of concern. The two things we talked about last week, one was, of course, the idea that the Fed was going to be coming up with a rate hike and the potential for either 3 or 4 rate hikes. And the question was, well, how strong is the economy? Where are they going to play? What number are they going to put out there in terms of the trajectory of the rate hikes into the future? And what we saw was, well, a little bit of, I would say, some confusion. Because it looks like there's 3, still maybe 4. And definitely seemed, from all aspects, that they were a little bit more hawkish than they usually are with Powell's first outing. We're going to talk a lot more about that with our guest today, like I said, Danielle DiMartino Booth, who's an insider, or was an insider, at the Fed and has some great information. We've had her on several times before. But before we get to that, let's talk about some of the things that really were moving markets. The other item that we talked about last week, aside from the Fed, of course, was this political concern that on the 23rd, it was going to be the time when the government had to come up with a plan in order to keep the budget rolling and the doors open and the government playing along. And it was, again, not so much the 11th hour this time, but what it was another crammed down 2,000-plus page bill that spent somewhere in the neighborhood of about $1.3 trillion. A massive spending bill in order to keep, not only to keep government open, but to appease each and every party that was going to vote yes on this deal. Otherwise, it looked like they were going to hold this thing up and potentially close down government for some time. That would have been probably disconcerting to markets. But I think really what went on with the announcement of tariffs that are going to be imposed on China, and the estimate is $50 to $60 billion. We're going to talk about that in a second, because if you watch what went on with that, and when President Trump signed on these quote-unquote tariffs, it was reported, I think, very incorrectly. And then on top of that, there was retaliations again. And again, just listen back of maybe 2 or 3 weeks. We talked about all the tariffs and what it means. Remember, I talked about the Bubba Gump tariff process. And now we're seeing another side, the retaliatory tariffs. and the mirror tariffs. All in the name of being fair. And yeah, I agree. China has taken advantage of us for many years, but there's still some good that comes out of the relationship that we have with them. No question about that. One of the things is that we get cheap goods. And cheap goods are good for our manufacturers, for our consumers. There's we are really upset about some of the intellectual property that they steal. And of course, the copycat of our products, I agree with that. But at the same time, what's going to come out of this? What's going to come out of the potential for poking the big bear? They get mad. They come back at you. And I guess the big thing that really disturbed me last week about the tariffs was this. That if you look at the news headlines and the articles and all the things that you saw that were coming into this announcement, there was an expectation of, I don't know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 or $60 billion of tariffs, right? That's what we all heard. That's what we all can think. And the news has said, yeah, there's tariffs. We have tariffs now in China. If you actually read what President Trump signed, it was not that at all. It was a plan or a declaration to look into the unfair trading practices of China, come back in 15 days with suggestions in areas that may require to have tariffs. Then we'll have a comment period, et cetera, and then they'll make some decisions. So how did they come up with $50 or $60 billion? Who gave that number out? I have no idea. Why is everybody upset? Well, I think the main reason is that now we have the idea that we are potentially going to be imposing tariffs on China, a major trading partner. Yet at the same time, we have no idea what those are going to be. China has no idea what those are going to be. And in doing so, creates a tremendous level of uncertainty. Now, it looks to me that once again, this is just another shot at the, quote, art of the deal. Let's put out there that we're going to do some tariffs and see if they come back and negotiate. Let's see if we can come up with a solution before it actually goes into play. Just look back at the tariffs on steel and aluminum. Do you know how many countries have been actually excluded from all this? It was supposed to be this broad-based tariff on all this dumping and protecting our steel companies here and the aluminum companies here in the United States and making it so that prices were better and there was more money. But when you look at actually what happened, the exclusions across the board really were, I would say, significant enough to not benefit the steel industry at all. In fact, if you look at the U.S. steel price, where it was on the day that they started talking about the potential for tariffs, where it went to up until the point that the tariffs were put on, and what happened right after, you'll see very clearly. Put a chart up of U.S. steel, symbol X. Put that up. The stock moved all the way up to about $50 per share. And now it's like $33.50 or let's call it $34. That's a big move. Why? Well, they made all sorts of plans to, you know, open plants again that had been idled for some time and bring back workers and start production again for the thought that, well, there's all these tariffs that are going to be out there and we're going to really have to ramp up what we're doing here. And in the end, the tariffs, first of all, on Canada and on Mexico and on Australia were removed. Now they're talking about Europe and a few other places. And there's a bunch of, South Korea, there's a bunch of places that have now been excluded from tariffs on steel and aluminum. So was it just simply a negotiation process? Maybe. But the problem now that you have, and again, make sure you don't take this as a political statement at all, because that's not what this is. It's how markets are reacting to what's going on, which is a fiscal move to create tariffs on certain goods. And when we now have uncertainty about what that's going to be for China, I think that's very troubling for markets. So when you combine that with the fact that now we have a 2,000-page bill that spends $1.3 trillion, that for the most part, most in the Congress and anybody that signed on or voted for this pretty much hasn't read. They don't know what this is because They got this about a day and a half before it actually had to be approved. But they pushed it through anyway. No fiscal restraint anymore. You wonder why the dollar is plummeting? It's moving down because people are realizing, wow, the U.S. is really doing some job at spending money that they don't have. And as such, maybe we don't want to buy their bonds. Maybe we don't want to be involved in their currency because it's kind of it's showing the potential to be very problematic from a debt standpoint. So all the things that came together last week, and a lot more than that, because it was more than we anticipated by a long shot. The headlines, the news, the information that flowed was going to be X, and it was probably X times five, much more than the market could handle. Between the upheaval in the White House, the firings, the rehirings, and then we saw the new tariffs, or at least the memorandum about tariffs on China being signed, and then the ordeal that went on with regard to the Congress and how they pushed this deal into play, and now how we have rates moving up. There's a lot going on last week. No wonder why markets puked. I mean, there's a lot. But where are we? Well, we're getting close to testing those lows again that we saw back in February. Not far off. Something that we anticipated, but kind of it seemed that it was not going to play out really well after the NASDAQ hit a new high after that February drop. NASDAQ had a new high. People were just pouring money in. And now the reverse is happening. Of course, led by Facebook, one of the biggest names in the NASDAQ. But it is quarter's end. So where do we have sentiment? Oftentimes you'll see about now into the next week. So Friday is the end of the quarter. So maybe Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, sometime around there, we'll see some painting of the tape, painting of the tape, which is basically getting things aligned, reallocating to make sure that everything looks really snazzy at the end of the quarter, that the names that you want on your list and the names that you do not want to show the people that you've been investing in are on or off. But now that the Dow is down for the year by 4%, the S&P is down by 3.2%, NASDAQ index is up 1.29%, a far cry from where they were. And where we're seeing, 5% plus declines in 1 week, and some of our key indicators that we look at, I have something we developed called the KRI, the Key Reversal Indicator. It's at a -5. Now, if you remember, I had talked about a few weeks back at the bottoms in February that, man, I was seeing numbers that were unbelievable, that I never saw before. In the history of our back testing a variety of different sentiment indicators, there were numbers coming up that I never saw. Now, we're not there just yet. But I wonder if we're going to see another flush down over the next few days, that will level off, cooler heads will prevail, realize that maybe we're not going to actually have this major trade war with China over this, what we did here, and there's going to be some posturing that goes on, but not an outright trade war. And rates, well, the Fed will back off if markets really freak out, so we realize that. Yes, the trajectory is higher, but they'll probably kind of slow up a little bit. And the realization that we have things like the Spearman indicator at -95, the McClellan at -140, I believe it is, around there. I mean, you have some pretty good numbers that show that we're getting towards a level on market sentiment that is considered really oversold. Now, oversold and overbought can remain for much longer than people anticipate. But I think that the trajectory that we saw last week and the week before into where we are now, a little bit hot from the aspect of people freaking out. Because it looked like on Friday, there was rampant selling of just everything. I don't believe necessarily that we are going to be I just can't imagine that we're going to be bouncing off what we saw, even though we're on the 200-day moving average, essentially for the S&P. The Dow is really close to it, and the NASDAQ is just below its 100. I don't necessarily think it's going to be the same as we saw last time with just a quick bounce and a recovery and off to the race again. I think there's going to be a lot of choppiness this year. I just can't see anything otherwise from all the things that we know are going on. Which leads to the potential for some pretty good trading opportunities. At the same time, I can tell you we've lightened up on our equity positions over the last several months. Right now, our core equity allocation in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy is, I think, 58%. That's about 10% or 8% lower than it was a quarter ago. That's pretty significant. And we've been hedging out our positions there on and off because it has been a bit too volatile to believe that it's just smooth sailing. Now the VIX is at 25. Still not headed up to where it was last time that things got so crazy. But like I said, I don't want to see a flush down with massive volume that undercuts the last. But I think it would be healthy if we stay in this range for a little while, not going so dramatically one way or the other that causes for people to freak out either in panic on the sell side or panic on the buy side. And again, we discussed this whole scenario, how it could play out a few times, but it seems that markets are really being very reactionary right now rather than respective of many of the backdrop of fundamentals that still seem to be pretty good. I got to tell you, even though you may say, oh, it's all artificial. I mean, generally speaking, the backdrop is okay. And I think that when you look at the people who look at, focusing on fundamentals, they're really going to be buying into this because they believe that earnings are growing and the economy is solid and we have a lot of really good things. Now, what does break that up is the uncertainty, is the constant rhetoric about, the firings and the tariffs and the Congress making laws that don't make sense and the money spend that's going on over here. And all of that is a problem. If we can contain that a little bit, just keep it quiet, we could possibly bounce off this. We'll see what happens. Anyway, a lot happening in the markets. Keep your eye on some of these sentiment indicators that I talked about. Keep your eye on, where we are on a technical basis because that's what's leading the charge right now. On the downside, we're seeing technicals really lead. All right, with that, let's get right to our guest because I have a lot of questions with regard to the Fed and what they did this week, and we can get caught up right now. And our guest today is Danielle DiMartino Booth from Money Strong, and she's a global thought leader on monetary policy and economics, and she's author of a great book called Fed Up, an insider's take on why the Federal Reserve is bad for America. You can get that over on Amazon. We'll have links on the show notes this week for that as well. And of course, with all the doings with the Fed and a new intro by our new leader, the head guy, I thought we'd bring her on. So how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I know that you're very much entrenched in what's going on. And we did see a rate hike this week and Powell take the stage. So I want to start out with a couple of questions on this because I know you've been involved with the Fed. You were inside, of course, but what's your take on the current composition of the Fed?
Well, it's interesting. I got the impression listening to Jay Powell that there was a distinct possibility that he did not care for the dot plot or find its utility. So I'm wondering if it's going to be cast off, if it's going to be a thing of the past at some point. But for the here and now, what was interesting was to see that in December, 10 out of the 16 members on the Federal Open Market Committee were of the opinion that 2018 could handle 4 rate hikes. In the March meeting that recently ended, we saw that 13 out of the 15 members of the committee thought that the economy could handle 4 rate hikes in 2018. So clearly there's been a more hawkish tilt to the committee And that's taking into account the fact that all of the members, including non-voters from districts, that's even taking them into account. But if you just look at voters, it is definitely a more hawkish year than it was in 2017.
But I think what's interesting about that was when we saw the composition change initially, and when Powell was, you know, put into place, the thought was, okay, it's going to be, you know, Yellen 2.0, that he's very dovish, or at least he was talking that. And the composition of the committees didn't seem that hawkish, and something changed, didn't it? Or am I just imagining this?
What changed was the media came around to reality. I was kicking and screaming going in because I felt that the conventional wisdom that he was a Yellen clone was so far off base. Mm-hmm. But that was probably because of my past experience, my being inside the Fed, and my knowing darn well that Jay Powell has always had the inclination to start shrinking the balance sheet. We saw in January, in fact, when the transcripts from the 2012 FOMC meetings were released, that even prior to voting for QE3, A, he had a ton of reservations about whether QE would work, but B, and much more importantly for what's happening in the here and now with quantitative tightening going on, he was very interested and adamant that they should have a solid exit strategy years and years ago. And that differentiated him back then from the doves on the committee.
So the, that's interesting because we go back and look at over time. And I was just for a moment reminiscing. And I was thinking back to the days when I thought the Fed was much more exciting. At least we go back, look at how things have gone. I thought from a fun factor with the Fed to more of a boring and very, just a kind of a academic view. So we had Greenspan. I don't know about you, but I thought he was a laugh riot. Seriously, I'm not kidding. I thought, trying to decipher what he was talking about was like the greatest puzzle in the world.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it was. It became a parlor game. But you have to stop and ask yourself, yes, was it entertaining? Absolutely. But should it have been? You know, he was interviewed by 60 Minutes after he left office, and he admitted on the air that he was purposefully, it was his objective to confuse the public with all of the gobbledygook and, crazy verbiage. He got a kick out of it. It really did pump his ego. And, you compare that to Jay Powell, quick, efficient, plain spoken, gets to the point, has a 43-minute press conference mm-hmm. after his first meeting that was to be followed with by a press conference. And look, I found it to be refreshing because that's what the Fed should be. We need to go back to the Fed not being entertaining.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. The funniest part about the whole Greenspan thing was when he talked, he was like a walking thesaurus, right? And during the meetings. And then as soon as he left the post of Fed chair and he was now selling a book and doing the whole tour and all, he seemed to all of a sudden have a normal or much more normal vocabulary. And he talked much clearer. I was like, wait a second. What's that about?
Sure.
So you talked about how, the Fed, it'd be better if they actually came and were much more matter of fact, maybe not the whole parade, the importance that everybody puts on them, et cetera, because over the years, over the last 10 years, listen, there's a lot of listeners that probably don't have any idea what a market that is not supported by the Fed looks like.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. I mean, for most investors' lives, there has been a Greenspan put followed by a Bernanke put followed by a Yellen put. People don't realize that in the weeks and months that followed the 1987 crash, Alan Greenspan advocated for sanctioned the New York Markets Desk leaking information to bond trading desks ahead of Fed moves to inject liquidity into the system. This is a documented fact.
Yeah.
And so we know that the markets have been supported by the Fed's purposefully mitigating consequences for taking risk for over 30 years.
Now, I think it's important for you to go back. Let's just step one further Fed chair back, which was Volcker. And Volcker, if you don't know of him, if you've never heard his name, essentially he was the inflation crusher, right? How did things go when he was doing his thing?
Well, I mean, Volcker suffered full-out mutiny on his board. Mm-hmm. They didn't record transcripts at the time, but there were, if you can imagine, there were times that he would have his entire board dissenting against him. It wasn't just pressure from the administration. He actually also had to deal with pressure from within, and that is why, you know, he was effectively fired by Reagan. But he didn't care. And that absolutely has to be the attitude of an apolitical, objective Fed chairman, chairwoman, is that they be completely independent and not give a darn what the constituency wants of them, but rather does right by the country.
Right. And by the way, right by the country, that does not translate necessarily to right by the markets necessarily.
Oh, not right? Especially not in this environment.
Right.
Because markets have become so dependent on the Fed placating them and putting a floor under asset prices.
Right.
So now it's, look, Jay Powell's in the most unenviable position in the country right now because of what he has, because of the challenges that he is faced with.
Well, he's coming in from the absolute lows where Yellen said, hey, thanks so much. Did a couple of rate hikes to say, you know, of course we're not, you know, totally one-sided. And then he comes in where now he has a lot of things that are hitting him that could possibly lead him to the requirement to raise rates and therefore be unpopular. But let's talk about that for a second, because one of the things that was asked in the press conference was, hey, what do you think about the whole idea of, well, there's a few things I want to talk about. Definitely want to talk about this tariffs and trade sanction issue and this protectionist environment. Do you think, or should the Fed be concerned? And he kind of like said, not really. We don't really think that that's going to be anything that's going to be a concern of ours, but should it be?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the way he couched the answer to that question was to say there were some members of the committee who raised concern. So that's a fairly straightforward way of saying I wasn't one of them.
Right. So in the background, this is happening, but I'm not really there.
Of course.
Yeah.
You know, I think it is more a reflection of Jay Powell, the pragmatic man, who really isn't all together convinced that the bite is going to be as bad as the bark. And I don't think that he believes that the Trump administration is going to try and put a nail into the coffin of the country and put it into recession by imposing tariffs and making sure that inflation goes sky high. Maybe he has faith in Larry Kudlow being new to the administration. I don't know, but it was obvious on a philosophical level, Powell was not losing sleep over what we've seen so far on the tariff front. Now, if we get into a full-blown trade war with China, I can guarantee you that everybody on the committee will be very worried about that.
Yeah, I mean, because what's interesting is that a full trade war, well, let's go backwards. Tariffs, non-trade war tariffs, if there is such a thing like that, you know, non-trade war tariffs could be inflationary, and that adds to all the other possible markers. And I know you've done some recent studies. We've talked about this. You've done some recent studies and a bit of a deep dive into the areas that are showing inflationary pressures. And I want to kind of get some of that from you. What are you finding? What are you seeing?
Well, we're seeing producer prices hovering at six-year highs. We hear anecdotally from companies of all sizes that they're having a very hard time with rising input prices. The National Federation of Independent Business, their most recent survey, 13% of the people who were queried about raising selling prices, in other words, passing those input price increases along, that's the highest that we've seen in this cycle. That's the highest we've seen in this century, that particular rating. And we're even seeing wage pressures bleed into, we're even seeing inflation pressures, excuse me, bleed into inflation. If you consider that 80% of the workforce is classified by the Bureau of Labor Statistics as non-supervisory workers. So we're talking 8 out of 10 workers. So it's the vast majority of workers. If you looked inside of that particular grouping of people, you saw that wages are running 3.1% year over year. Clearly the market did not see that, because the market saw the 2.6% number and breathed a sigh of relief. If you look further inside of that, you see that people who work in transportation, their raises their wages are rising at 3.8% year over year. Manufacturing, 3.9% year over year. Construction, 4% year over year. These are real numbers, and they're the highest we have seen in quite some time, and they will compel the Fed to fight that inflation as it starts to bleed into the aggregate measures.
So now, but let me just give you some a question on this. In terms of the year-over-year wage pressures or wage increases, how much of that, if any, it can be attributable to those one-offs or, you know, these kind of raises that were given because of the tax cuts that were given? Is any of that maybe creating...
We wouldn't see bonuses. So we wouldn't see those $1,000 bonuses that grab so many headlines. What we would see, though, would be bleed through from the raises to minimum wages. We would see increases if the tax cuts actually compelled companies to give their employees raises. And we sure as heck would see the influence of record insurance proceeds that flowed into the economy thanks to 3 hurricanes and 2 wildfires
right. In
2017. And that is truly, we can only hope, a one-off episode that will also bring with it quite the hangover.
So we have inflation, and it's clear that we've seen that. I mean, anecdotally, you know, when you talk to somebody who's looking just at a spreadsheet, like, there's no inflation for the longest time. Right? No inflation. I'm like, okay, but everything's costing me more. Well, what's costing you more? Well, is gas costing you more? Well, a little bit, but not really. Okay, so that's not costing you more. What's costing you more? Well, health insurance. All right, well, health insurance. You go through the thing, food costs are down. They're not really down, by the way. But the problem is when you see, there's two sets of data that I looked at last week, and you tell me what you think about this. The one was import and export prices. Import prices rose significantly more a bit more than is expected. Export prices actually dropped and were softer than were expected. So hold that thought from what I saw. The second one was the CPI and PPI. And the PPI was a bit softer PPI was a bit stronger than expected. And on a relative basis, CPI was a little bit lighter. So what that adds up to me is that if you have prices that are going up into the manufacturing process and then selling those products at a or exporting them at a lower cost or not at the same level, it seems to me we're seeing some potential for margin compression.
Those are going to be the key words for 2018. Because again, you have to be able to pass those prices along, especially in the face of, by the way, you mentioned gasoline, gas prices being up 12% year over year. Mm-hmm. And that was as of the last CPI report. We know that oil prices have skipped up by another $5 a barrel. So that pressure is going to intensify. And that is the one that is extremely visible to households. It is when gasoline is the one thing that makes households perceive inflation faster than anything else. But the flip side of that is if you're Joe Q manufacturer or you're producing something or you're providing a service, if people are paying more for their necessities, they will not have as much money to put into discretionary spending. And that pressure will continue to intensify on their margins, especially if they're having to pay up more for employees.
Yeah. And so that margin pressure leads companies then to hike prices to relieve some of that margin pressure as much as they can and push the envelope, thereby another inflation point that is possibly out there. LIBOR. Can you explain to everybody this? It's been in the headlines, this whole LIBOR thing. So we've seen like the 10-year, you know, 10-year bond, it clipped about 292 after the Fed meeting, and it kind of, which made sense that things were rising a bit after a 25 basis point rise, and the question of whether it's going to be 3 or 4, and, you know, a little bit of the concern about how much of the quantitative easing they're going to continue doing and whether or not they're going to be using the dot plots and all that. But LIBOR has been screaming higher. What does that mean?
Well, right now, LIBOR is screaming higher in part because of this wave of repatriation that's going on that has caused a shortage in the funding markets overseas. So that is, to use your term again, something of a one-off. But it's certainly not the only thing that is driving LIBOR higher. I think LIBOR is sniffing out to a greater extent the increase that we're going to be seeing in Treasury issuance going forward. And I think that LIBOR is also reflective of inflation building in the United States and anticipation of Fed rate hikes. What's interesting is when you compare LIBOR, which has some credit risk built into it, to the Fed funds rate, which is theoretically the risk-free rate, and the spread between the two of those, the LIBOR, quote-unquote, LIBOR OIS spread, is at the widest in years, and that is screaming that the Fed is going to have to hike rates to close that gap. So it is really, really fascinating to watch what's going on in LIBOR because it affects so much.
Right. That's what I'm talking about, because right there, if you have years ago, they've changed from some of the newer mortgages. If you have an adjustable rate mortgage, maybe done it several years ago, or you have maybe, some kind of a unsecured note that you have from a bank. I mean, a lot of this stuff was based for a long time on LIBOR. It changed to a few other ones. But if you have that and you're seeing LIBOR rise, you may have a problem. Many of the embedded contractual levels of interest rate that would be on bank notes and things like that could be based on LIBOR, and that moving up so dramatically really causes a curtailing of liquidity in the markets, doesn't it?
Of course it does. It's really fascinating to me, at least, and you've been around for as long as I've been around in these markets. When sell side brokerage firms start to make rumblings, you know that, I mean, it is the ultimate late cycle indicator is when a sell side firm starts to worry about what the future holds. So when Goldman Sachs this past week puts out a report that says liquidity is the new leverage and that the market infrastructure itself in the current cycle is going to be what ends up being problematic for markets in the form of liquidity, or I should say the lack thereof, You really have to stop and think about that in the context of a post-Dodd-Frank world. They may be rolling back some of the worst restrictions, but nevertheless, you know, brokerage firms hold 80-some-odd% less bonds than they used to in inventory. So any liquidity crisis, any liquidity crunch that we have, like the one you're describing building up in the LIBOR market, is going to be exacerbated by harebrained regulations that should have never been imposed, because you don't have the broker-dealer community come this cycle as a backstop.
Meanwhile, everybody says buy. Everybody uses the tax cuts as a buying proposition, and the repatriation as a buying proposition, and the earnings growth as a buying proposition, and also the buybacks as a buying proposition. By the way, they'll never say sell anyway. No matter what happens, if the markets come down, they say buy. If the markets go up, they say buy. I mean, that's the general what you see on TV all the time and on the radios and what people are talking about. Are we at an inflection point with this whole liquidity issue that people should really, listeners, you know, what should they care about this? Obviously, there's a difference between over the next 6 months versus over the next 20 years, but is there something really brewing here that is not being told? Is that what you're saying?
Well, look, you are right. People involved in the investment world like something that is called a J-O-B. Yeah. They want to keep their J-O-B.
Yeah.
And that means making sure that everybody's always 100% long the market.
Mm-hmm.
It's an intuitive fact. But from the perspective of investors, that means that every word that comes out of their mouth, you have to take with a gigantic grain of salt. But what they're not talking about is, you know, a report that came out last year, some very important and simple math. When you sum up the inadvertent tapering occurring at the Bank of Japan and the very real and purposeful taper going on at the European Central Bank and the quantitative tightening going on here in the United States, the balance sheet shrinkage, if you will, that should be $420 billion this year. When you add up all three central banks' effective tightening compared to last year, you literally go from having $2 trillion of global quantitative easing to $1 trillion of global quantitative easing in 2018. I apologize for the former members of the FOMC who tried to serve us the Kool-Aid, but quantitative tightening, where the go-go juice that's been given to markets is cut in half, is not going to be like watching paint dry.
Yeah, it's good. I would tend to agree with that. And I think the thing that is the most interesting to me is that there's a phrase that was used for so long and then they stopped using it. The phrase was, don't fight the Fed, right? That was for the last 10 years or so, don't fight the Fed. But what's interesting is once rates start rising, nobody talks about that anymore. You know, now it's, well, our research has shown that over the first few years of a rate tightening cycle, the economy is really getting strong and things are really good and blah, blah. And, you know, really stocks can hold up and do very well, especially this sector or that sector. But they forget about the don't fight the Fed, don't they?
Well, that's mighty convenient, isn't it?
Yeah, well, so many conveniences. It's everything's convenient. It's convenient because you don't get on TV by being really negative. They don't let you back.
It is curious that this mantra, this drumbeat, has finally been silenced. It really is telling, but it's bigger than don't fight the Fed, because again, I'll go back to what I was saying before. On a global level, after the Federal Reserve completed its tapering of purchases and just put the balance sheet on autopilot with reinvestments, at that point in time, it was actually an inflection point at which time global quantitative easing accelerated. And now we have $20 trillion collectively on central bank balance sheets worldwide. A recent report showed that that was almost half of global GDP. So the mantra should have been, don't fight QE.
Yeah.
That's really good. What it came down to.
Yep.
And now that should also be silenced.
Yep,
but it's bigger than don't fight the Fed.
I hear you. Danielle DiMartino Booth. You can always find out what she's talking about. She's been all over the TV. You're looking real good and strong and staying money strong, and make sure you fight the good fight.
I will continue to fight the good fight. Happily so. I have no agenda. And I'll continue speaking the truth.
All right. Appreciate it. We'll put all the information on how to contact her, about her book and all that, on the show notes for episode number 553 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. Great discussion with Danielle, because I think she really has a good grasp and understands the dynamics of what goes on and thoughts that happen when it comes to the Fed. She gives a really good and, I think, unique insight into what's happening and what we should really, what we should know about, and how this really affects us and impacts the investment world. And so pay attention to her. I really like having her on. Well, we're going to end it there. I hope that you enjoyed yourself this week. I hope that next week you're going to be making some money. Let me know any questions that you have. You can always write me and go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the Ask Andrew button. and send me your comments, your concerns, your questions, whatever it is. We'll try to get it on the show in an upcoming episode. Until next week, I bid you adieu.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.